We're messing with our equipment here. You can tell. We like to do these kinds of things. Okay, again, just to very briefly kind of set you up what we're doing here again. Dave, perhaps you'd like to give them a very, very brief recap of some of the stuff that was in the first Radio Free America Aryan Nations broadcast.
Now, the whole, what we're really using the Aryan Nations title for here is kind of as an umbrella name, not only to cover the umbrella organization, the Aryan Nations, which is a neo-Nazi organization, but we're really using Aryan Nations as an opportunity to investigate the historical development and progress of American fascism. Now, one of the things that we were looking at is the intersection between the forces bringing fascism to bear in Germany and the forces bringing it to bear in the United States. Specifically, the transatlantic industrial axis, which was instrumental in arming Hitler's Third Reich, and which, as we looked at, also played a very key role in not only attempting to overthrow the U.S. government, but in financing domestic fascist groups toward that end. Now, one of the things that we looked at were two attempted military coup d'etat in the United States, two fascist coups. We looked at one in 1934, an attempted coup, where the houses of Morgan and DuPont, the DuPont industrial family, which, of course, involves DuPont Chemical, also General Motors, the DuPonts own a controlling interest in General Motors, and also the Morgan interests. The Morgans are bankers of long standing, and they have generally capitalized the DuPonts' industrial enterprises. They loaned them the money for them to get these organizations started. So the Morgans and DuPonts are inextricably linked. They are both part of the same industrial and financial group, and between them, and with some other interests, they were very much interested in getting rid of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. Toward that end, in 1934, they instigated a fascist coup. Fortunately, the man who they picked to lead it was the former commandant of the Marine Corps, Smedley Butler, who, in spite of being an outspoken conservative and critic of the Roosevelt administration, he was not a fascist. He was a loyal constitutionalist, and so he betrayed that coup, and it never came off. It came very close to coming off, and one of the things that we looked at was the fact that General Douglas MacArthur was the first choice of the Morgan interests to head the coup. They were suspicious of Smedley Butler, with good reason, as it turns out, since he betrayed them. And one of the things we also looked at was the fact that MacArthur was the brother-in-law of a guy named Edward Stotesbury, who, in addition to being a financier of American fascism, was also a partner in the Morgan Bank and a fabulously wealthy man. MacArthur's first wife was his daughter. And one of the people that we looked at, we didn't fully appreciate his significance. We're going to go into that this evening. The other choice, the second choice of the Morgan group, was a guy named Hanford McNider. Now, Hanford McNider was described as a wealthy Iowa manufacturer and an American Legion member. What we did not know at the time and what we've learned since was that Hanford McNider was also a member of MacArthur's staff. He served under Douglas MacArthur in both World Wars. And we took a look at a number of different fascists who MacArthur had on his staff. General Charles Willoughby, his intelligence officer, who was German-born, pro-Franco, and a doctrinaire and outspoken fascist. We took a look at a guy named General Courtney Whitney, a virulent anti-Semite, who we're going to touch back on this evening. We took a look at a guy named General George Van Horn Moseley, and we're going to come back to him in a second. He was a doctrinaire fascist as well. We also took a look at a guy named Andres Soriano, who was Franco's representative in the Philippines, later a colonel on MacArthur's staff. Now, George Van Horn Moseley was a MacArthur staffer who was the choice of not only American fascists but also German intelligence to head up another attempted military coup d'etat in 1939. That coup involved not only domestic American fascists, but also elements of German intelligence. And we looked at a number of different fascists who supported and worked with German intelligence and MacArthur staffer Van Horn Moseley. And we also found that many of these people, such as William Dudley Pelley of the Silver Shirts and Gerald L.K. Smith, were very big on having Douglas MacArthur for president in 1944. And we're going to take a look back at MacArthur's 44 presidential bid, if one could call it, this evening. Now, Gerald L.K. Smith ran a thing called the Christian Nationalist Party. He was a doctrinaire fascist, and his Christian Nationalist Party nominated Douglas MacArthur to be president in 1952. Now, the fellow who nominated him was none other than Wesley Swift, who was a key official of Gerald L.K. Smith's party. He also was the founder of the Aryan Nations, or the Christian Defense League, or the Identity Movement, as it is variously known under its shifting series of titles. Now, one of the things that we're going to be looking at this evening, one of the questions we're going to be proposing, basically, is, was the assassination of President Kennedy the culmination of a long effort on the part of American fascists and elements within the military who resented civilian control of the military as our Constitution, which was established by our Constitution? And we're going to be asking, and we think obviously the answer is yes, is whether or not the assassination of President Kennedy represents the culmination of these events. We looked at two unsuccessful military coups involving or centering around MacArthur's staff, and we're going to take a look this evening at what we think was a successful military coup. Another thing we're going to be looking at is the development of German fascism on both sides of the Atlantic. Again, you can sort of think of German and American fascism as two halves of a tuning fork or a wishbone where they're joined at the base, because really the forces bringing fascism to power in Germany as well as in the United States are basically that industrial axis of which the Morgans and DuPonts are part. So we're going to be looking at, again, intersections between German and American fascism and both halves of the tuning fork, I guess you could say. And one of the things that we concluded the first broadcast with was a look at how the Nazi Party developed in Germany. In a nutshell, all of the democratic leaders of Germany were systematically assassinated by underground murder organizations which were set up by the German army. These operated in the 20s. Long before Hitler came to power, they were paving his way to power with corpses, specifically the corpses of the democratic leadership of Germany. Now, these units were called the Freikorps and alternately Black Reichswehr, and they were essentially underground extensions of the German military. We then took a look at how the German Nazi Party was formed. Initially, it was a defunct political party that was infiltrated by a group of undercover German army intelligence agents and then used as a vehicle for militarization. Specifically, the American Nazi Party, or the German Nazi Party, was the vehicle for introducing the German army into civilian society in order to propel it in a rightward direction. One of the questions we're going to be looking at this evening as we compare the structural organization, many similarities between the John Birch Society and the German Nazi Party, is to what extent the John Birch Society functions in the same capacity in the United States. And that's sort of the essence of it. Remember, too, that old Adolf Hitler got his start as an undercover German army informant who infiltrated the unsuccessful German Revolution and betrayed it. And those are some of the things to be thinking about this evening. And what we're going to do is sort of skip back and pick up the thread from the end of the broadcast last time. The first thing we're going to read you this evening, we read you at the sort of near the end of Radio Free America number 10, the first of our Aryan Nations shows.
Okay, this first selection is from American Swastika, a book by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M, published by Doubleday and Company, Garden City, New York, 1985. Immediately after World War II, Nazi activism in America continued apace. Such fascists as Merwin K. Hart of the Constitutional Educational League and Gerald L. K. Smith proceeded without interruption in their various activities. In May 1951, Smith's The Cross and the Flag, which is a publication which had not been interrupted by the inconvenient advent of World War II, reproduced an article from an early 1915 issue of the United States Military Academy Howitzer Yearbook, which gave a description of Dwight D. Eisenhower as a Jew. The article stated that Eisenhower was a, quote, Swedish kike, unquote, and otherwise vilified him in the most scabrous manner. Harry S. Truman was also branded a Jew. His middle name became Solomon. Skipping on down. On the other hand, Gerald L. K. Smith and several other fascists were keenly in support of General Douglas MacArthur and fought for his nomination for president in 1952. Students of history may recall that MacArthur was mentioned by the 1934 conspirators, who sought to overthrow the government, as a possible alternative to General Smedley D. Butler of the Marines as president. MacArthur did not consent to any such nomination for a so-called third party, but his name was still used on the tickets. Vivian Kellems, K-E-L-L-E-M-S, who, it will be recalled, had corresponded through World War II with a Nazi agent Count von Seidlitz in Buenos Aires and had fought personal income tax, was named as vice president by the so-called Constitution Party. Another nominee was California State Senator Jack Tenney. After Eisenhower's inauguration, the Constitution Party kept up its attack. Senator McCarthy had its full endorsement during the Fort Monmouth scandal, when he used, quote, evidence of a communist spy ring at the fort quote, in order to flush it free of Jews, unquote. Skipping down. The organizations proliferated in the 1950s to a degree almost inconceivable, even in the careless rapture of the early 1940s. There was the Congress of Freedom, not to be confused with a more intellectually respectable CIA-connected Congress for Cultural Freedom, and the aggressive group headed by Dan Smoot of Dallas, a self-styled authority on every aspect of communism, whose favorite targets were Ed Murrow, Jack Kennedy, and, needless to say, Eleanor Roosevelt. There was H.L. Hunt, worth approximately $3 billion with an income of $50 million a year, whose Lifeline Foundation received a postal subsidy and a tax exemption as a religious organization. Lifeline had 300 radio stations and 55 television stations, emitting a constant stream of Nazi-fied propaganda in collaboration with Dan Smoot, Merwin K. Hart, and Gerald Smith. The John Birch Society climbed on the bandwagon. Okay, just a couple of things to point out there real quickly. Again, notice that although MacArthur, in this case, did not want to be put on the ticket of the Constitution Party, he was, in fact, their supported nominee. He had been mentioned earlier by the 1934 conspirators as a perhaps alternative to Smedley Butler. Skipping down a little bit, you notice again that the these various groups, especially Dan Smoot's group, favorite targets Ed Murrow, Jack Kennedy. Now, this is in the 1950s when Kennedy was only probably a congressman and then a senator. Jack Kennedy already, and of course Eleanor Roosevelt. And most importantly, perhaps, for what we're going to be talking about later, the Hunt family, rearing their heads here, worth $3 billion, an income of $50 million, and running their organization, 300 radio stations and 55 television stations of Nazi propaganda. And we will get back to these folks.
Well, a word about the Hunts, who are going to be front and center, particularly H.L. Hunt, has sort of been regarded as a ludicrous figure in American history, and just how ill-conceived that notion is, just how serious a figure H.L. Hunt is or was, and his sons are today, we're going to be talking about. Just consider, no matter how wild the idea is, if you had 300 radio stations and 55 television stations at your disposal, think about the information you could get out. Think about the information we could get out. It'd be nice. Now, we're going to take a look back at, skip back a couple of years in history now, and we're going to take a look at the attempts to get MacArthur to run briefly, the attempts to get MacArthur to run for president in 1944. Now, recall that we looked at Van Horn Moseley, Gerald L.K. Smith, who we just heard about, and William Dudley Pelley, of the pro-Nazi and Third Reich-linked Sober Shirts, and their efforts to get MacArthur to run for president in 44. Recall that the Silver Shirts, a member of the Silver Shirts, founded the Posse Comitatus, another of the instrumental links in the Aryan Nations. And by the way, the Christian Defense League's William Potter Gale was also a member of MacArthur's staff. That's one of the things that keyed our discussion initially. About MacArthur's attempted run at the 1944 presidency, we're going to read about this very briefly from a book called The Years of MacArthur, Volume 3, by a man named D. Clayton James. That book is published in hardcover by Houghton Mifflin Company in Boston in 1985. This third volume is the most recent volume. This three-volume biography is very famous of MacArthur, and the third volume has just come out. It covers the years 1945, the end of World War II, through 1964, when MacArthur died. And James writes about the 44 campaign here. It is true that the evidence implicating MacArthur directly in the presidential campaign on his behalf in 1944 is slim. He remained well in the background, never publicly revealing an interest in the Republican nomination, and allowing trusted staff officers such as Whitney, Willoughby, Lloyd A. Lerbas, L-E-H-R-B-A-S, and Philip F. La Follette to act as liaisons with dedicated activists in the United States. While the McCormick, Hearst, Patterson and Scripps Howard publications promoted his command feats in the war against Japan and his attributes as presidential timber, Robert E. Wood, W-O-O-D, the Sears and Roebuck board chairman and former head of the Isolationist America First Committee, and Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg, the influential Republican leader from Michigan, plotted a low-key strategy that would have the convention delegates primed to choose MacArthur as a dark horse when the expected stalemate occurred between Thomas E. Dewey and Wendell L. Willkie. But the pro-MacArthur excitement spread beyond their control, with MacArthur for President organizations springing up in several states and a number of notorious reactionaries like Gerald L.K. Smith joining the cause. Now recall that Gerald L.K. Smith, later his Constitution and Christian Nationalist parties, nominate MacArthur for President. Wesley Swift, founder of the Aryan Nations, replace that nomination, as we saw. Now, there are a couple of important things to look at in the section we just read. First of all, take note of something that we're going to come back to shortly, which is that the Army officers here were promoting that MacArthur allowed officers of his staff to basically handle the legwork in generating his presidential candidacy. That's important. We're going to come back to that. For our purposes here, maybe the most important thing is to take a look at Robert E. Wood, head of what D. Clayton James euphemistically refers to as the Isolationist America First Committee, because the America First Committee and its chairman, Robert Wood, who is very close to MacArthur for a long time, were not just isolationists. They were a lot more than that.
Indeed. And we're going to read a small section here from Charles Higham's book, already mentioned, American Swastika.
By the way, we're reading a lot of stuff from American Swastika tonight as well. There are many other books about this, and some of them in even more depth than American Swastika, but this is it's an excellent book, and one of the reasons we're going to it so often is that it's currently available. For years, we've been talking about this material and have not been in a position to recommend books like Trading with the Enemy and American Swastika by Higham, which are available at any retail book outlet. So that's one of the reasons we're drumming on this so heavily, is that these are available. It's a tremendous boon, but the material we're reading from this is just a drop in the bucket compared to the other material in the book, and it is currently available.
Okay, now again, to sort of draw a larger picture here, as later on we are going to connect elements of MacArthur's staff and their political beliefs with certain events going on in MacArthur's sphere of influence in Asia and Southeast Asia, right now we're also pointing out the fact that while MacArthur himself, whatever the truth of his political beliefs are, and of course this has been a source of debate for many, many years, the political beliefs of many of his underlings are quite well known, and Dave and I have talked about them. And the involvement of certain of these people in certain other groups, America First being one of them, is something that needs to be looked into a little closer, and that's what we're doing here. Again, from Charles Higham's American Swastika. On December 17, 1941, 10 days after Pearl Harbor, Charles A. Lindbergh, the famous Lone Eagle, and possibly the most celebrated of America's national heroes, addressed a meeting of 50 individuals of the America First Committee, assembled at the home of Edwin S. Webster, at 35 Beekman Place, New York. Webster was New York secretary of the committee. Lindbergh said that for years America had been speaking of the yellow peril, yet now we, quote, are fighting on the side of the Russians and Chinese, unquote. He went on to say that the U.S. government, quote, had no plan and does not know for what it is fighting, unquote. Lindbergh went on to say that, quote, there was only one danger in the world, namely the yellow danger, that China and Japan in reality were, quote, allied together against the white race, and that Germany, quote, could have been used as a weapon against this alliance in collaboration with the United States. Lindbergh said that the ideal program would have included Germany taking over Russia and Poland in collaboration with the British as a block against the yellow race and Bolshevism, but that, so he stated, quote, the British and the fools in Washington had to interfere. He said that Britain, quote, was the real cause of all the trouble in the world today. Lindbergh stated that now that the war was on, America First must be on the alert for the time when the American people, by reason of the lists of the missing and statements of war losses, realized they had been betrayed by the British and the administration. And, of course, this is the Roosevelt administration. He said that then America First would be, quote, a political force and could, quote, negotiate peace with Nazi Germany. No clearer statement could have been made of the position of the extreme right wing of the United States. America First was at the heart of the international plan to secure a lasting peace with the Third Reich. The philosophy was based on ideological as well as financial considerations. Purity of race and the destruction of Jewry and communism, allied with financial empire building all over the world. In other words, a purpose identical with that of the German extreme right. The keynote speech of America First was delivered by Acting Chairman General Robert E. Wood on October 4, 1940, before the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. General Wood contended that totalitarian states could not be destroyed by war, and that a German-dominated Europe would not destroy our foreign trade. Intervention in the war must be avoided at all costs. Skipping down, a friend of the committee was Colonel Robert R. McCormick, of the Chicago Tribune, William J. Grace, who had Nazi connections, and Avery Brundage, chairman of the Olympic Games Committee, pro-Nazi and supporter of sending a team to the Hitler Games in 1936, were others prominent in the organization. The committee published a monthly called Equality, containing such articles as John L. Lewis's attack on conscription and Senator Wheeler's, that's Burton K. Wheeler, Senator Wheeler's demand for protection of American youth from death overseas. The committee was nationwide. There were 250 chapters and 750 units throughout the country, with a total of 5 million members. America First was incorporated in New York, California, and Missouri. It was on behalf of the committee that Senator Wheeler distributed 1 million copies of a congressionally franked postcard in 1941 discouraging men from joining the Army. $1 million per annum poured into America First in 1941 to make its activities possible. That money was received from Nazi sources, as revealed by J. Edgar Hoover in a secret memorandum to the president dated February 23, 1942, and now declassified at Hyde Park. Hoover advised that the organization was far more dangerous than the Bund. That's, of course, the German-American Bund. That if Hitler had destroyed England, America First would have raised a rallying cry to have Roosevelt impeached and Lindbergh made president in a new grand alliance with Hitler.
Now, Robert Wood, who's the head of that organization, is a long-standing friend of MacArthur's and continued to support MacArthur and correspond with him regularly long after the end of World War II. Now, one of the interesting things about MacArthur's 44 campaign, which Gerald L. K. Smith, William Dudley Pelley, and Robert Wood, among others, supported, was, as indicated a while back in the material from Clayton James, MacArthur allowed his officers, his staff officers, to promote his candidacy. Now, in most descriptions of the 44, of the abortive 44 election try, campaign try by MacArthur, his chances are sort of poo-pooed, and the whole thing is sort of given short shrift, like it really was not all that serious an effort. And we're going to look at some information now which would suggest that it wasn't just a handful of reactionaries and a few arch-reactionary or fascist industrialists who wanted MacArthur to be president, but there was serious maneuvering at a very high level in the government to get him back to the United States and as president. We're going to look at some material now from a book called Bodyguard of Lies. That's authored by Anthony Cave or Cave Brown, C-A-V-E. Published in hardcover, and there's a softcover edition out, by Harper and Row in 1975. And we're going to read now from the first volume of the two hardbound volumes. Among Marshall's most influential advisors were General Stanley D. Embick, E-M-B-I-C-K, the former chief of the War Plans Division and former deputy chief of staff of the United States Army. An elder statesman and kingmaker in the American military hierarchy, Embick, both in person and through his son-in-law, General Albert C. Wedemeyer, W-E-D-E-M-E-Y-E-R, the chief of the U.S. Strategy and Policy Group, was a powerful voice in shaping American military plans. In November of 1942, he undertook the task, with Wedemeyer, of assessing the truth behind the Rococo personality and oratory of Churchill. Skipping down, the American policymakers were far from unanimous in their commitment to the rapid defeat of Germany. American troops and shipping scheduled to arrive in Britain for the pre-invasion buildup, that's pre-D-Day, pre-Normandy landing, for the pre-invasion buildup were being diverted to the Pacific. A plan was afoot to present MacArthur to the American electorate as a presidential candidate in 1944, and victories in the Pacific were required to increase his stature to the point where he would be uncontestable. So, a couple of points to make here, that the 44 election campaign by MacArthur, which he allowed his staff officers to initiate and to sort of handle the legwork for, was not just sort of a pipe dream of a handful of reactionaries, but high-level military planners were diverting American troops to the Pacific in order to give MacArthur an early and glorious victory so that he could return home. This is very high-level maneuvering, and perhaps the most important thing for our purposes here is to note the affinity and the association here between Albert C. Wedemeyer, who's going to be one of the major focuses of our broadcast, and General Douglas MacArthur. Wedemeyer, in addition to helping to divert the troops to the Pacific, was very much involved with promoting MacArthur's candidacy, and we're going to take a look at that.
Okay. Reading from the years of MacArthur, earlier mentioned, in the fall of 1947, General Albert C. Wedemeyer, a Taft advisor, in this case this is Senator Robert Taft, Republican leading light, a Taft advisor who had formerly headed the American forces in the China Theater, wrote MacArthur, quote, "I predict that should you return early next spring, you will be acclaimed by a vast majority as the logical man to be president in this critical period of our history. I know Bob and Martha Taft quite well, and I am quite certain that he would throw his support in your direction, unquote. Hanford McNider, MMacNider, a retired general who had served under MacArthur in both World Wars and now was a well-to-do cement manufacturer in Iowa, told MacArthur in September 1947 that his leadership was needed, quote, if we are to save this republic. Not having received an answer to his June letter, Wood wrote to the general again in October. He observed that, quote, whatever city I go to, I am visited by many prominent businessmen or professional men who are tremendously anxious to see you nominated. Of course, that was Robert Wood of the America First.
Now, note that not only Robert Wood, but Albert Wiedemeyer, who is going to be, as I say, one of the main focuses of the broadcast, were promoting MacArthur's candidacy in addition to 44, where Wiedemeyer was diverting troops to the Pacific Theater and Wood was active, but also in 1947, obviously promoting him for the 48 campaign. Now, interestingly enough, that guy Hanford McNider, who was also a long-standing supporter of MacArthur's and was very active also in promoting him for president, Hanford McNider was the second choice of the Morgan Group to head up the 1934 fascist coup, which Smedley Butler was able to deep six by betraying the coup. Now, Hanford McNider, we knew that he was the second choice, but Hanford McNider was also an officer under MacArthur in both World Wars, so we have yet another fascist basically cropping up on MacArthur's staff. And again, we're going to take a look at some of MacArthur's views, and they're pretty reactionary. If MacArthur himself was not a doctrinaire fascist, as we said last time, he has to have been one of the most foolish men ever, because he had all of virtually his entire staff appear to be arch-reactionaries, if not downright explicit fascists, and the MacArthur crew are going to be front and center this evening. Now, the going back to the book that we've been reading from, The Years of MacArthur by D. Clayton James, we're going to take a look now at some of the people who are going to figure in MacArthur's 1952 attempt for the Republican nomination. A week before General O'Donnell's testimony as the final witness at the Senate hearings, that concerns Senate hearings about the fall of China and how that happened, MacArthur embarked on a round of nationwide appearances that lasted until shortly after the Republican National Convention in July of 1952. Many of his critics were convinced that he was trying to build up support for another MacArthur for President boom, particularly since most of his remarks were typical right-wing Republican blasts at the Democratic administration's record. According to Whitney, however, MacArthur decided to launch, quote, a blunt, hard-hitting crusade aimed at revitalizing the nation, unquote. He was deeply concerned because the same moral dry rot that infected U.S.-Korean policy was also eating away at our conduct of affairs at home. Most of his travel expenses, including the use of planes, were covered by ultra-conservative, well-to-do Republicans like Texas oil man H.L. Hunt and Clint Murchison, spelled M-U-R-C-H-I-S-O-N. We're going to come back to Hunt a lot this evening. We'll touch back on Murchison in the next broadcast. Continuing. Given the home base of his principal financial backers, it is not surprising that he began his crusade in Texas. At Austin on June 13th, he addressed the Texas legislature decrying, quote, appeasement on the battlefield and declaring, our first line of defense for Western Europe is not the Elbe, not the Rhine, it is the Yalu. But he hit hard, too, on the subjects of corruption in Washington and spiraling federal budgets and taxes. At Houston the following day, he addressed a crowd of about 25,000 in Rice Stadium and participated in a parade in his honor. In his Houston speech, he pleased conservatives by warning of the dangers to the free enterprise system posed by an overgrown central government that exercises despotic power, unquote, tramples people's rights, spreads false propaganda to destroy moral precepts, and exacts excessive taxes. One of the things to note as we look at MacArthur's political philosophy here, see if this doesn't sound like some of the people who are on the scene today, and see if some of these phrases don't ring familiar. The horror of high, unjust income taxes became a favorite theme of his tour. It was a topic that had not previously excited him during his 71 years. Satisfying any devotees of McCarthy in his Houston audience, he added that these insidious forces working from within, unquote, which were to be feared more than the threat of external attack, unquote, included those who seek to convert us to a form of socialistic endeavor leading directly to the path of communist slavery. Now, later, James goes on to talk about a speech that MacArthur made in front of the Massachusetts legislature. And he refers to some remarks made in that speech, and this is going to be one of the keys to the broadcast this evening. James writes, later in his speech, he left no doubt how deep was his hostility toward Truman and how distorted was his own interpretation of an American military officer's oath. Quoting from that speech, men of significant stature in national affairs appear to cower before the threat of reprisal if the truth be expressed in criticism of those in higher public authority. For example, I find in existence a new and heretofore unknown and dangerous concept that the members of our armed forces owe primary allegiance and loyalty to those who temporarily exercise the authority of the executive branch of government, rather than to the country and its constitution which they are sworn to defend. No proposition could be more dangerous. None could cast greater doubt upon the integrity of the armed services. Unquote. And, of course, a couple of remarks to make about these passages we read. The posse comitatus, a major element of Aryan nations, is specifically anti-tax, so MacArthur's anti-tax views, while not unique, are interesting in light of the connections between Aryan nations and the MacArthur staff historically that we've been looking at. Most importantly, though, Douglas MacArthur, who was removed as the commander of the UN forces in Korea for wishing to exceed presidential directives and carry the war into the Chinese mainland himself, was obviously very bitter about that, and in addition to resenting Truman's removal of him, it's worth noting here that what MacArthur is essentially espousing here is treasonous. What he's saying specifically is that he doesn't like the idea that the military is subject to civilian authority. Of course, the framers of the U.S. Constitution specifically gave command the control of the armed forces to a civilian commander-in-chief, the President of the United States. What MacArthur is saying there basically is he doesn't think that's a good idea and that it could be interpreted as, if not treasonous, certainly indicating disloyalty to the basic precepts of America. And the constitutional conflict, I guess you could say, between the military and the executive branch and the Constitution itself is basically going to be one of the major focuses of our program.
And indeed, what we're going to focus on for a moment here is another significant and important military officer allied with MacArthur, somebody who had been urging MacArthur to run for president, as we will find out himself with a rather curious idea of what constituted military loyalty to the Constitution, as opposed to the executive branch of government. Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who eventually became the commander-in-chief of the China Theater, replacing General Joseph Stilwell. Now, back in May of 1941, or April of 1941, rather, sometime after the Lend-Lease Act had been passed, the Lend-Lease Act, of course, was the United States agreement basically to support Britain economically against the Nazis. While Roosevelt was trying to muster sentiment in the among the public and in the Congress to eventually, as Roosevelt knew would have to happen, have the United States go to war with Germany. Anyway, Chief of Staff General George C. Marshall asked the War Plans Division, of which Wiedemeyer was the head, I believe, at that time, to work up a plan for war in Europe to be fought, as any army, especially one the size of a major power like the United States, has to do, to work up a plan for war in Europe for the upcoming conflict. Now, reading again from Charles Higham's American Swastika. On September 11, 1941, the Army summarized its estimate along with naval requirements in a secret joint report, buttressed with appendixes, maps, charts, tables, and secret data on strategic assumptions and purposes, potential military objectives and targets, and estimates of military strength. Known as Rainbow Five, this remarkable document, running to some 17 pages originally but greatly expanded thereafter, called for an outright defeat of Nazi Germany in 1943, for which an appropriation of $150 billion would be required. U.S. Army ground forces would be required to a total of 216 divisions, 61 of them armored, 51 separate motorized divisions, and a half a million men for anti-aircraft artillery units. It may be necessary to repeat that this was quite the most important single document in the possession of the Chiefs of Staff and of the White House. The architect of Rainbow Five was Brigadier General Leonard T. Gerow, G-E-R-O-W, Chief of the War Plans Division. Secretary of War Stimson had handed the responsibility to General Marshall, who in turn passed it to Gerow. Gerow selected as his instrument of execution of the victory program Colonel Albert C. Wiedemeyer, who in the 1980s, was to be resurrected from the military mortuary to serve as special military advisor to President Ronald Reagan. Okay, so this is the same Albert C. Wiedemeyer we're talking about, who recently has been, as Haim puts it, resurrected from the military mortuary to serve as special military advisor to Reagan. Colonel Wiedemeyer had an interesting history. His father's parents were born in Germany, and he himself had been educated in part at the German War College in Berlin, otherwise known as the Kriegsakademie.
He graduated in 1938 as the Nazis were moving, or during the year the Nazis were moving into Austria.
That's right, and I believe that all the other things, the Nazi racial laws and things like that, had been on the books for quite some time. Okay, so Wiedemeyer rented his apartment in the German capital from a member of the Nazi party, Gerhard Rosbach, R-O-S-S-B-A-C-H. We'll get back to him. And during his sojourn became a great friend of General Ludwig Beck, chief of the German General Staff. His introductions to Beck were arranged by Lieutenant General Friedrich von Bettecher, B-O-E-T-T-I-C-H-E-R, German military attaché in Washington. He corresponded regularly with his German contacts until the advent of World War II in Europe. He was friendly with Charles Lindbergh and acted as his interpreter in German uniform when the Lone Eagle visited various Nazi factories and army posts. And he was a keen supporter of General Robert Wood, the head of America First. Rightly or wrongly, he was regarded by the German embassy in Washington as part of the pro-German military clique in the War Department. There is no question that he was a convinced isolationist who sincerely believed that the United States was not obliged to commit itself to war on behalf of Great Britain. Okay, before I go on with this, let me just point out a couple of things real quickly. Okay, Wiedemeyer graduated, as Dave mentioned, from the Kriegsakademie in 1938. He acted as an interpreter for Lindbergh while wearing a German uniform when Lindbergh was visiting Nazi factories. And he was a keen supporter of Robert Wood, the head of America First. And as we previously mentioned, America First, while on the surface an isolationist group, was in fact being funded by the Nazi Party, the German Nazis. This is important to remember. Okay, going on. Wiedemeyer was in his soul opposed to the purpose expressed in the very victory program to which he was assigned. Precisely why Roosevelt instructed him to draw up the plan, and then why Wiedemeyer chose to execute it, can only be regarded as a joint execution of executive duty, which overrode personal considerations.
In order to understand a little bit more about Wiedemeyer, and we're going to be looking at him extensively this evening, let's take a look at some of the people that he was associated with. We're going to look at Gerhard Rosbach at greater length here in just a second. A couple of remarks. General Friedrich von Bettecher was not only the German military attaché in Washington, but a key person involved with the basically German espionage and attempted subversion of the United States. So Bettecher is a key person for Wiedemeyer to be very close to. Now, it's also worth noting that he was a very close personal friend of General Ludwig Beck of the German General Staff. Now, Beck, although a bitter opponent of Adolf Hitler's, was a very, very dedicated Nazi. I think the one thing we might point out here for future purposes is the difference between anti-Hitler and anti-Nazi. There were many dedicated doctrinaire fascists and Nazis in Germany who hated Hitler for one reason or another. Some of them regarded him as low class. Many of them, including Ludwig Beck, differed with him very sharply on tactical considerations. Beck was one of the earliest defenders of the rights of German troops to join the Nazi Party. The first two open Nazis in the regular German army were in his unit, and he defended them very vehemently. Beck was regarded as the very embodiment of Prussian militarism, and as such, he differed with the sort of two-front war and conscript military philosophy that Hitler used, and he preferred a more limited war and using some of the traditional Bismarckian political alliances in order to gain victory. So Beck, who was a very close person, very close personal friend of Wiedemeyer's, was a very dedicated Nazi, although he did hate Hitler and eventually was executed by Hitler. It's worth noting, though, that he was a doctrinaire fascist and, as I say, regarded by many as the very embodiment of the spirit of Prussian militarism, which is something I think most Americans would not want to have too closely associated with anyone in our own general staff. Now, Gerhard Rosbach, from whom Wiedemeyer was renting his apartment, is a really, really important figure in the history of Nazism. Now, as we pointed out, the road to Hitler's ascension to power was paved by the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr, who simply murdered anyone who might have gotten in Hitler's way. Gerhard Rossbach was a key Freikorps leader, and we're going to take a look at some of his future endeavors in the Nazi Party in a minute. Now, not only was Rossbach a Freikorps leader, but Martin Bormann, perhaps the single most important person in the history of Nazism, if one looks at the entire course of that movement from 1919 up to the present day, was Martin Bormann, the number two man in the Reich officially, but in reality not only the most powerful, but also the most intelligent person in the Third Reich, and as we'll see in future programs, one of the dominant forces in modern history. Truly a genius, albeit an evil genius, but a very, very powerful man and a key figure in history. Of Gerhard Rossbach, his Freikorps, and Martin Bormann's beginning in that, we're going to take a look at information about it from a book called The Bormann Brotherhood. That was authored by William Stevenson, Stevenson. And that's to be distinguished from William Stevenson, spelled with a PH, who was a British intelligence agent, codenamed Intrepid. This William Stevenson was a Royal Navy pilot during the war and is now a broadcast journalist with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. His Bormann Brotherhood was published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich of New York, and it was copyrighted in 1973. Of Rossbach and Martin Bormann's start in the Rossbach Freikorps, he writes as follows. Speaking of Bormann, his love of money, his greed for power, were commented upon by Gerhard Rossbach in an interview many years later. Rossbach had led a Freikorps, a group of armed volunteers supported by the German army, which had been restricted in the number of regular soldiers it could keep on the books by the Versailles Treaty. Bormann became treasurer of the group after it underwent several changes of name to evade the law. The mission of the Freikorps was to weed out weaklings, said to have caused German sufferings. The groups were also used to fight Bolshevik forces on the eastern frontier. But the young German Republican government also saw them as a threat to its own existence. They were declared illegal in 1920, but were more active than ever by 1923 when the French executed Leo Schlageter, a Freikorps soldier, for industrial sabotage. And so remember that Martin Bormann gets his start with the Rossbach Freikorps, and that Gerhard Rossbach rents his apartment to Albert Wiedemeyer while Wiedemeyer is in Germany.
Another brief look at Gerhard Rossbach and how the part that he played in some of these things, and the fact that he was rather a significant person, although his name is not very well known to us. This is a very short segment from a book called Der Führer, Hitler's Rise to Power, written by Konrad Heiden, H-E-I-D-E-N, translated by Ralph Mannheim, and published by Houghton Mifflin Company in 1944. This is one of those hard-to-find books Dave was alluding to earlier. Talking about Gerhard Rossbach, Konrad Heiden writes, Lieutenant Rossbach's troop, roaring, brawling, carousing, smashing windows, shedding blood, and nevertheless seeking the light of freedom, was equally proud to be, quote, different from the others. Heines, somebody he'd been talking about earlier, had belonged to it before joining Hitler. Then Rossbach and Heines had formed a center with Röhm, and that, of course, was Röhm, the head of the SA, the stormtroopers, Ernst Röhm. It led the SA while Hitler was under arrest. I'm sorry, it led the SA while Hitler was under arrest. So essentially what they're saying is that Rossbach and this other man, Heines, had formed a particular troop that led the stormtroopers while Hitler was under arrest. So Rossbach and this other man were essentially, for a while, substitute Führers of the movement before the Nazis came to elected power.
Now, one of the things that we've looked at here on this broadcast for a long time is, of course, the incorporation of many Nazis into the CIA and our military at the end of World War II. We'll be taking a look at that more later in the broadcast. Worth noting here that Gerhard Rossbach, in whose Freikorps unit we find the janitor of Martin Bormann, the political janitor of Martin Bormann, the fellow who led the stormtroopers while Hitler was in Landsberg prison, and the fellow who later rents his apartment to Albert Wiedemeyer after the war, went to work for, among others, the CIA. Returning again to the Bormann Brotherhood by William Stevenson. Rossbach, who was a Nazi intelligence agent in France and Turkey during World War II, was known to Western intelligence as an old man with a considerable and reliable memory for detail. Until his death at the age of 74 on September 1, 1967, he was consulted regularly by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and historians. So another Nazi connected to the CIA.